history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there. Amazing stories, sometimes hard to believe stories, waiting to be told if we'll just ask a few questions and be patient enough to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do that, we're always better off for it. We're educated, we're entertained. Often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. At the National World War II Memorial this week, General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, gave the keynote address in a ceremony commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Iwo Jima, a battle his father survived as a World War II Marine. Something else happened in the early stages of that five-week battle for that small but strategically located volcanic island. It's something that hasn't happened at all in the 75 years since. The sinking of the escort carrier USS Bismarck Sea on February 21, 1945, remains the last time an American carrier was sunk by enemy action. We're going to focus on that 75th anniversary this week through the memories of two men who survived that tragic sinking that claimed the lives of more than 300 of their shipmates. Steve Marusich, one of 11 children in his family in Binghamton, New York, was a rear-facing gunner on a TBF Avenger torpedo plane flying off the deck of the USS Bismarck Sea.
Well, I tell you, everyone was excited because it was the biggest fleet of ships I'd ever seen. There were hundreds of ships in the area, battleships, cruisers, heavy cruisers, destroyers, big carriers, and there were about a dozen of us little guys. And we were there for almost a week, and it was our responsibility to fly over the island and drop our bombs and try to make things difficult for the Japanese, to get ready so that the Marines could come ashore.
When you say you'd never seen a bigger fleet, a bigger group of ships, when you got to Iwo Jima and you saw so much firepower on the American side, did you ever think, we need all this for this little island? Is that something that occurred to you?
Yes, I was surprised that the Japanese were so well fortified. They had to be all underground because that island was sure peppered every day for 6 or 7 days. The big 16-inch guns from the battleships and the big carriers had much more firepower than we did, but that was our duty, to just go over and drop bombs on the island and see if you could soften them up.
And when you were flying those missions and dropping bomb after bomb and knowing all these other planes were too, did you see anything down below that made you think that this was going to be much of a fight?
No, it didn't look that ominous. It was just an island with very little vegetation, and we kept wondering why the heck we were there, because it didn't look like there was much on the island to be fighting for, although later on I found out that that airstrip was vital to the B-29s to hit Tokyo, so that was our mission, to see if we can't soften it up and maybe give the Marines a better chance to get the island.
For people who haven't been there, and I think most of us listening have not been to Iwo Jima, we've certainly seen pictures of the giant mound, Mount Suribachi on one end of the island, and then more of a flat strip going from there. What did it look like to you, and certainly from the air? Was there something striking about that location?
Nothing striking other than Suribachi at one end, and it looked like a simple thing to get that island, but when you found out that there were thousands of Japanese underground, and the Marines had a heck of a time getting there because there was very little foliage or shrubs or anything to cover. So when they invaded that island, those Marines were outstanding and to be able to get those Japanese out of there.
And early on in that invasion, Steve, after your primary job of hitting the island before the invasion was done, there was a bit of a commotion aboard your carrier. What was that all about?
On the day that we met the enemy, my shipmate and I were sitting on the on the hangar deck aft on the starboard side, and we were getting ready to go eat. It was about 6:30 at night, and as we were sitting there talking, ready to go and to start our chow that night, why, the guns start firing off and the general quarter sounded, and we stood up and turned towards the bow of the ship. And just as we turned, the first suicide plane hit us about, 20 or 30 feet in, on the starboard side where my shipmate and I were standing. And we were blown down the hangar deck about, I would say maybe 20, 30 feet. And the explosion hit me in the back of the head and my back, my legs. And after laying there a few seconds, I got up and started walking towards the bow of the ship. And not walking very well, I was kind of wondering if my legs were broken or not. Anyway, by the time I got up forward about another 20, 30 yards, the second suicide plane came down and hit our above our after elevator and knocked our torpedoes off, and the torpedoes began exploding, and the ship was damaged very severely. And another half a minute or so, the skipper came on and told us to abandon ship. Moving forward, I went up to the forward gun sponson where there were, I think, 20-millimeter cannons. They had a big line over the side, and I was fortunate I got up that far, took my helmet off. My jacket was gone. It was blown off my back. And I went over the side on the big line, and after dropping a few feet, we're up about 45, 50 feet, and one of the shipmates above me was stepping on my hands, so I let go of the rope and went down about 25 feet and hit the water and started floating and swimming away from the ship. After that, we started congregating out in the sea, and because the Japanese were still in the area, the other ships couldn't turn their lights on because the Japs were still strafing us in the water and still firing at ships. So it was about 4 hours later that they began to pick us up and the lights came on. And they pulled me aboard a destroyer escort, and they picked up almost 400 of us. And I was fortunate to be put aboard a destroyer. We were given, alcohol nourishment. Most of us were very cold and had very little energy, and we took all our clothes off. They gave us new clothes, and the sailors on board that destroyer escort were very helpful in pulling all of us aboard and giving us some alcohol. Either it was brandy or some other thing to take the chill off our bodies. And in those days, I wasn't familiar with that alcohol, so it was quite an exciting to get such heat in your stomach. So the next day, they took us into Iwo Jima and put us on a big transport and made it into a hospital ship, and it was right below Mount Suribachi. And later that morning, the skipper came on and announced to all of us, if they would look up on the mountain, you'll see the flag flying. And the flag went up on Iwo Jima, the one that most people in World War II recognize as a victory symbol for those Americans who wanted us to be successful in the war.
And I've heard a lot of stories that people have about where they were when they saw that flag go up, and it has symbolic value for just about everyone. But I imagine for you, as someone who's just had your ship sunk and you were almost killed, to see something like that probably had a lot of symbolic value for you.
It was very emotional to all of those sailors that were around me. They all were so enthused, and we were so happy that the Americans went up on that mountain, and the Japs were still in that mountain because they were shooting at us in the harbor, and the Marines still got up there and put that flag up there. And the symbol of our flag sure is a freedom symbol to all the people of the world. I think we just can't imagine how much it means to us to see the flag flying and to know we're still free.
Let's go back, because you brought us to that story of where you were when you saw Mount Suribachi, but that was a pretty eventful way that you ended up where you were. So you're on this carrier, and you mentioned the first suicide plane, the kamikaze. Now, had you seen a kamikaze attack before that day on February 21st?
Well, we did have some occasion to see them operate at Leyte, but not in this large numbers. And to see them, I was on the hangar deck, so I didn't get to see all of them flying, but my shipmates told me they usually like the Bendix air races. They were just running around those ships, firing at everybody, and I don't know why he chose our carrier, but they used it as a target, and they took us down. I didn't know how to sew very well, and I had safety wire going through my buttonhole, so I didn't have any buttons. So when that first one took me, why, it blew my jacket off, and I had to laugh because I had no buttons. And but when I got in the water, after spending about 4 hours or so in the water, it was very cold. People don't realize it, but the water was like, I don't know, they say it was like 57 degrees, and swells were real high. I don't know, maybe 15 feet or so, maybe 20. And floating around there, after 3 or 4 hours, your body begins to feel the effects of the exposure. And it was very difficult when the destroyer escort came close. I could see the screws turning in the fantail, and they had the cargo net over to the side. I grabbed the cargo net, and I'm a pretty husky kid, and I couldn't pull myself up. I was pretty weak. And those sailors, they were dragging us out. They reached down and pulled me up, threw me on the deck, and they grabbed the next guy. They picked 400 of us up. And they were heroes, too, I'm telling you. Those sailors were really busy getting all of us survivors out of the water in very rough conditions.
I don't want to belabor the point, but I think everyone at home is trying to imagine themselves in your shoes or in your life preserver at that moment. But this is everybody's worst nightmare. Your ship has been hit. After 90 minutes, it's completely under the water. It's sunk. You're still floating in the water, not knowing if you'll ever be picked up. What was going through your mind? What kept you going? How did you survive that situation?
What was so interesting about it was the fact that one or two of my shipmates came by, and one had a leaking life preserver, and I showed them how to inflate it. There were little tubes along the side that you could release and blow the chambers up, and so I showed them how to do that. Another one came and did the same thing. And then I saw a group of 15 or 20 around a small life raft, and I figured I better not get too close. I'll stay away, and when the lights come on, they'll see that big group around that life raft, and I'll paddle closer to it so I can get aboard when they find them. So that was my experience in the water, and with a Jap strafing us there, that was a very dastardly deed. I was really amazed that they would do that.
Because you guys are defenseless in the water. You can't fire at them.
Yeah, you see the bullets hitting the water, and you just hope that they don't get you.
How close did they come to you?
Well, I was maybe about 15, 20 feet away from the splashes of the bullets. But fortunately, you could hear some screams going on. A lot of the guys got hit. And one of the reports that was written about our night's attack explains that we lost quite a few boys in the water because of the strafing.
And in total, more than 300 men from your ship died that day?
We had a total, I think it went around 321 or two that never made it and that were missing. And we put a plaque in their honor on the Yorktown. I think it's in Charleston. And we dedicated this monument with all the names of those that didn't make it, and to honor them for what they did to preserve our freedom.
You know, I don't want to put any words in your mouth or put my thoughts in yours, but I'm just wondering if you spent 4 hours in the water, and you had talked about when you heard the news of Pearl Harbor, you were singing in your church choir. So was the guy raised in the Orthodox Church saying a few prayers while you're floating in the water for 4 hours?
Well, I think it was a constant memory of, if the Lord's going to help me, now's the time to do his job, because we're so busy trying to stay afloat, and my preserver wasn't that functional. I had to blow it up a couple times, and the only thing was that when we're on board ship, we had to wear this. It was a life preserver, and it was the order of the day. Everybody wore one of those belts. So when we went over the side, most everyone that I was familiar with had one of these on.
What do you think the chances are that you would have survived without one of those?
Very nil. I'm not a very good swimmer, and to be in the water that long, I don't know how to float very well. I can dog paddle a while, but I couldn't have done it for 3 hours because that's how long it took before they were able to pick me up, almost 4 hours. But anyway, I'm glad I survived, and I think the Lord was on my side.
Steve Marusich would use the GI Bill to earn a bachelor's degree at Western State in Colorado, then a master's at Stanford. He was a longtime teacher and administrator, as well as an outstanding golfer. Steve passed away in 2015, but his incredible memories live on as we mark 75 years since the sinking of the USS Bismarck Sea, the last time any American carrier was sunk in combat. When we come back, another survivor of that tragedy who's still with us, and you won't believe what he endured on February 21st. 1945. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode marking 75 years since the last time any American aircraft carrier was sunk by enemy action. It was the USS Bismarck Sea on February 21st, 1945. You can find related photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we're going to hear from another survivor now. Albert Henderson resides now at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno. But 75 years ago, he was a cook making his home along with more than 900 other sailors aboard that escort carrier off of Iwo Jima.
I was like any other day. The flight crew and everybody's up early. We had to have early chow for all the guys that worked on airplanes and all the landing gear guys and stuff like that. So they got the special deal up early, a little more of a choice. And no problem because it's just routine. You just do it. Good. Thanks. See you later. Adios, mother. And that's it. But as it started getting little dusk, then you kind of be concerned because you're still taking planes. Well, we can only hold so many. And then they start taking them down below. Well, then they don't have time to degauss them, and that's bad news. And that wasn't my job, but I knew what was going on. I was all over that ship. When we'd be in port and I'd come back, I'd go every compartment, everything, know which way to go, what would be open, what wouldn't be. And that was the biggest concern. But we didn't. I was locked in compartments getting chow ready for the minute we secured because everybody's hungry.
So how did you experience what happened and that moment that all of a sudden what seemed like a routine day became anything but?
Humongous explosion. And I was one deck below the hangar deck, and the next deck down was the magazines. And that was always kind of a sore thing where the galley was and below with gas and then all the 500-pounders and torpedoes and everything, because once they start, it's like firecrackers, one will light another.
So you'd been aware that if you guys had been hit like this, you probably weren't going to make it given where you were.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Got it. You were sitting on a ticking time bomb.
Yeah. So when that happened, I had just secured the chow. I always tried to get ahead of everything in case guys get back quicker, because you can always undo something, but you can't do it if you don't have the time. So when that, well, we have one hatch going to, there's two men in there, the guys to look after things and take care of things. That's their job, damage control. So myself, Art, my buddy, and probably six of us finishing up. I'd already released a couple of guys, and they went back to another battle station. And they, like I said, they took me off my gun, so I didn't go anymore.
Well, and where your ship was hit on the starboard side was real near one of those 40-millimeter stations.
Yeah, it was completely blown off.
Was that the station that you used to?
That was mine. But it seemed like about a third of that fantail, everything left.
Well, but I mean, my point is, if they hadn't changed that, if they hadn't put you back in the kitchen, you would have been a goner right there, because that's exactly where, well, the kamikaze hit.
And this kid that I give my life preserver to took my place with my life preserver, and that was gone too. So fate, I've always thought fate and God will help you, but in that relationship, you got to do your part. So then when that started, we run over there to grab a fire hose and turned it on. There was no water. Well, then the word come along that it knocked out all of our fire hose in the fire, and the whole aft section and the port and starboard side both. Everything was gone. So then the other plane come in and just followed suit. So I was trying to figure, well, what's up, coach? So I told the guys, I said, we're going to have to check that hatch and close that because watertight. A couple places on the deck above the ladders, which is stairs, cracked a little bit and gas was running through, and it was starting to catch fire coming down the stairs, and that was a little scary because you don't know if it's a airplane there above you, is where he parked all these planes, or if that's the main gas line that's busted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's buku gallons there, meaning lots of gas.
Yeah.
Then I told him we need to go over there and check it out. We asked this one kid come running through there, and I asked him where the other guy was. He's, I don't know. So we couldn't get any water, so we shut it off, and I thought, well, that's not good, but we got to shut that hatch because we're dead stinking fish and we don't get it closed.
Because you need to cut off the explosive risk.
Yes, because mm-hmm. it's just, it's, you can't hardly stand. So we run over there and dog it down, and nobody come out, so we dogged it down, and just before we got the hatch shut, about halfway, I was standing there, and a big hit me. I didn't know about concussion, but it pushed me and slammed me against the wall with the bulkheads about 8 foot away, and I thought I was dead. We didn't know about that. We didn't have it in the movies them days, those type explosions. Once in a while, a Western would have something, but bodies didn't flow like this. I just, backwards.
Was this the second plane hitting, or was this an explosion as a chain reaction?
That was from our magazines blowing up.
So both planes have hit by now.
Yes.
And it's starting to set off different explosive material aboard the ship.
Uh-huh.
So an explosion happens
down in the, where all the ammunition dumped was.
And what did it feel like?
Just this compressed air. I until later in life, I didn't. And then I watched movies and see where guys hit and blow up, and I thought, whoa.
So you got blown into a wall.
Yeah, and I thought I must be dead because that hurt so bad. But see, I didn't know whether to lay on the floor or what, but you really don't have time to think. Either do it, done it, or should have.
Right.
That was what really hurt so bad. Then I got up. I was all right. And so I said, well, we got to get out of here. And everybody concurred. We're going to go down all the way forward and topside. You can't go in the hangar deck or the other compartments because that's where all the fire was. So I knew how to get everywhere. Like I say, I'd been every place in that ship. And they had battle lanterns. You're not supposed to touch them. But anyway, they brought this kid up from the engine room. He's injured pretty bad. And the guy was just exhausted carrying him up, and then he laid him there. And I said, we'll get to topside. And so everybody took hold. But the passageways aren't too wide. You can't just walk. You kind of have to get close and string out to carry something
mm-hmm.
because they're not made for that.
Right.
Certain places, plenty of room. But anyway, so we take him and get topside. And on the way up, you open the compartment, watertight door, and everything is like a foot and a half so up, and you put your leg over there, it's nothing but water. Well, you don't know if it's just starting there or if that's the end of it or what.
Right.
But you got no choice.
So you could be stepping into a room where you're going to drown.
That's it.
But you don't know until you get there.
That's right. So you're not supposed to That's those battle lanterns. But there by the officer's mess, they had about three or four of them. And I said, you know who I am. You can tell them I took it. But we need this light. We got to get this guy topside.
Because it's just dark everywhere.
Well, yeah, and you don't know.
You don't know what's in front of you.
You haven't, because they're knocking out everything. Took all of our power, water fighting, everything. So you don't know. You can't take that chance. And this, as far as I knew, there might not be another light that I could take with me. So anyway, I took it. So we went topside, and then we got up there, and then we went to the island. That's where we laid him down, and we all thought he was gone, but we still thought, that's great, we got him here. And that son of a gun raised up and said, don't leave me, fellas. That kills you. Absolutely. What are you going to do?
Right. Here, you thought he was dead.
Yeah, and then he says that. Well, naturally, but how are you going to take care of him? You can't take care of yourself. I didn't even have any life belt.
And you don't know how to swim.
Yeah, well, in the water like that, swimming is not all that great because you'd be up and down like a yo-yo and it'll slam you back. I got off the ship twice, it threw me back on twice. But I kept thinking, I'm going to get off of here.
Explain that to us. I don't want to gloss past that, as everyone's saying. So, well, let's stay with where we are in the story, I guess.
Yeah.
So you're finally topside.
Yeah.
One question comes to mind. You mentioned taking the lantern. Do you think you would have made it topside if you hadn't had that light?
I'll never know because we had light. And I don't know if we'd been able to see. Some of the little compartments up front were storage of stores, supplies, clean equipment, paint lockers, parachute stalls. You never knew, but I knew where we was going because I'd been there several times. Like I say, yeah. I was all over the ship for my own good. To this day, if I rent a place, I'm going to know where the gas meter is, electrical power, and the water.
After that experience.
Well, because if something happens during... I'm there. I know where to go.
Life and death.
Yes. And we've had maintenance men here. Couldn't even know how to turn their water off. So it does. It's food for thought. It's
Hey.
But anyway, we got him topside, and I said, I'll go aboard the aircraft. There's always this one-man rafts back of the pilot. And you just pull this one button and flip it out. I go and jump on the first one, and I pump it back, and it's gone. I think, gosh, that's strange. So about the third one, and then I got the message. They're all gone. So I said, that's okay. Sick bay, I was there a couple months ago, and there's a bin outside the door. It's got all these life preservers in for all guys in sick bay. They never know how many's going to be there. I was myself in there for 4 or 5 days. So I go up there, and the bin was completely empty. And I can't believe, hey, God, I need a life belt. So I go outside and... back, and I told my buddy Art, I says, you stay here, I'll be right back, but I'm going to be gone. And I says, it's going to take me a little time, but I'll hurry, but you stay here. I will.
And is there fire still burning all over the place too?
Oh yes, in the backside. You can't go that way at all, period.
Right.
And things will take off and blast away. I get back out there, and my buddy Art's gone, and I holler, and of course you start to holler and the explosion goes off, and you can't hear nothing, but you at the time you think you're doing all right.
So Art had stayed with the wounded sailor, but now they're both gone?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Both gone. So I still was concerned because I've got to get off of there. I've got to have something to float on. And I'm thinking about my odds if I go down below. No chance. Where would I go? Where would there be even a life preserver? So I thought, well, that's okay. I'll make do without. So I'm there pondering, and I know already that I can't go off on the starboard side because that'll take me past where all these explosions are. And we got a destroyer escort coming up, coming almost, but he won't come close because he's afraid of getting shot with our own torpedoes through his ship from our fire in the magazine.
Right, because stuff's just going off randomly.
So he cuts off, and he just gets up a little bit ahead, and then he has to shut out all his light, and he takes off. Well, the Japanese planes are coming back, and they're strafing guys in the water. So I thought, good deal. This is really great. I thought they was kidding me because this guy that come up there, he was hauling. I don't know where he's going because you ask somebody, they don't even know where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them made sense and some didn't. But you can't be worried too much because you're not going to be everybody's helper. You just can't. So I said, okay. And I thought, well, I guess so. I went forward, and that's when I proceeded to make myself life preservers anyway. I took my shoes and saved the laces, and so I was going to tie my legs and make it wet and float. And the big wave, I just got down the rope ladder, and I'm there all gung-ho, and I'm up and down like this, and the wave carried me up, and my hands go up, and I lost my britches and my shoelaces. Well, I didn't have underclothes on for a reasoning. It's too hot when we're in battle because you have to control that. They need all the energy to run the ship.
Right.
So a lot of electrical components, they shut off, and air conditioning per se.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought, okay, so I thought I'll just use the shirt. So I done the same thing, the shirt tied thing. I didn't have my string anymore, so I just tied knots. We had to wear a long sleeve shirt, but I didn't have any undershorts or shorts on because it was hot. And I figured, well, that's going to help a lot, and it did. But here I am, naked as jaybird, which is, I didn't care. Who's going to look? Peek-a-boo. But anyway, seemed ironic, and I got in the water again on a down the rope ladder right there, and it threw me clear up, almost the middle of the deck, clear up on the forecastle.
So this is twice now you've tried to get off the ship, but the waves knocked you further back onto the ship.
But I didn't want to get off on that side because you're going to float back where it's blowing off. About a third of the ship just disappeared.
Right.
And I thought, well, Coach, you know better than that. You got to go down this side and around.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't get off on the other side, so I got back. That's where I went, to the bow, right up there.
So that's the third time now.
Yeah. And
and you're naked.
Yeah, and colder than, well, man, it was cold. But I didn't have time to worry with it.
But did you hold on to your shirt this time, or did it
I lost it.
So you lost your pants, trying to use that as a life preserver. You lost your shirt.
And
now you got nothing.
Got nothing. A ruptured belly button, probably. But outside of that, nothing. So I get up there, and I keep thinking, well, I'm going to wait here to the last minute because I can't swim, and it's too rough. You couldn't swim anyway, so I didn't really miss it. But I'll dog paddle. That's fine. But I hadn't planned on doing it by the hour because I had done it in swimming pools by the hour, but I'd always reach over and grab the bank when the coach wasn't watching. And by the time he turned around, I'm really going like crazy. First thing you know, I'm just up there on the bow. And a lot of things you read, the ship rolled over and sank. Well, that's not really exactly true. From the ship being blown that much at the back, it was filling up water. That ship, practically the whole bow, clumped out of the water. Not quite, but higher and higher, and I'm looking at it like, what's going on now? Get away from the ship. The suction's going to pull you down. We've been taught that tooth and nail. Every time we take swimming lessons, no matter where it was, jump from the tower, 1, 2, 3, push. And all that, you still remember that. So that was our big concern, but not thinking that the water's gradually going to go up there, but all of a sudden it's more and more and more. It's not going to be any suction left because it's already full of water.
Mm.
But it did force the bow up because the water's back here making the tail heavy.
Right. So the tail's going into the water. The bow is poking up vertically out of the water.
Yeah, and I'm looking up at that thing, and I thought, well, man, if that comes down, I got to get out of here. So that's when I played like it must be 2 or 3 dogs, because I really dog paddled in.
Are you imagining yourself in his position yet? It's time for a break, but we are nowhere near done. What else would it require for that 19-year-old sailor to survive? Hear it in his words when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and this episode marking 75 years since the sinking of the escort carrier USS Bismarck C, still the last American carrier ever lost to enemy action. It was hit by two kamikazes on February 21, 1945, with multiple explosions to follow as munitions throughout the ship were detonated. Albert Henderson was a 19-year-old cook who you heard described trying to abandon ship multiple times, only to be washed back aboard by giant swells. When he finally did make it into the waters off of Iwo Jima, he had zero clothing, and there was another problem. He really didn't know how to swim.
But this other guy bailed off about that time. And I'm going, and I get out to him, and I grabbed a hold of him, and he liked to come unglued. And the minute I seen him, it was just dusked and getting dark, but mm-hmm. you could still see pretty good, and especially from the fire. And he just come unglued. "You're going to sink us and drown us." I said, ho, partner. "It don't take but about a cup of air. You can float if you don't panic." I said, "Let's say a prayer. That might help." And he was not with all of his cookies at the moment. He was so upset.
Sure, understandably so in that situation.
And, of course, naked guy come up to him and grab him on the shoulder. That would have upset anybody. I probably would have really learned to swim in a hurry had that happened to me. So anyway, and the waves were up here and he's down here, and we passed the night and he's up here, and then it starts getting darker. And then all of a sudden I'm going, and here's this plank of wood coming out. I said, "My God, it's a two before. That's that teak wood that they store underneath the flight deck. So when they puncture the flight deck, the planes, they go up and repair it with wood because it's a wood deck. If they stored it right underneath, I know exactly where it come from. It's all tied down in there, and it just stays there, and nobody touches it. But it broke loose. I got my plank back."
You were a plank owner after all.
Yeah, and that was mine.
So all of a sudden you have something to hold on to that's going to keep you afloat.
Yeah, but the problem is like that, I was doing it, but you can't hold it tight because then you'll just go like a cartwheel because the waves, see, is so big
mm-hmm.
and you're such a small person. So I found out if I just hold it loosely, it likes to beat you to death because it's turning. But anyway, I lost it because if you'd be up and down and backwards and all of a sudden, where's my plank? It just disappeared.
Sure.
I don't know how long I had it. It was weird because he was right there, and then he drifted away. And I asked him to say a prayer, and we did together and everything. So,
what do you pray in a moment like that?
God, help me through it. And you go by hours. It seemed like a week. And you're so tired. And you might think, well, God, you know I need help. And then you think, oh, I guess you're busy.
Mm.
I see all these little flashlights. They give us flashlights to put on our life belts. Just a little cell. You can see them bobbing all over. But you can't get to them because by the time you one step forward, three backwards.
With the waves.
Yeah. So anyway, that was that. And pretty soon I took and seen a light come across. It's above me. So then the wave takes me up. There's no light. And I'm starting down, and all of a sudden this light goes above me again. I think, that's a motor whaleboat out there. I couldn't hear it because of the water and everything. All of a sudden I spot this white thing there. That's a sign that was up by the skipper's quarters where they had a sun deck built, and the sign reserved for officers only. And I've been up there a dozen times because I used to take steaks up for him,
mm-hmm.
not for him, but for his Filipino cook. So I knew where it come from. And I said, I've got to get that sign. And then when I see the light coming, hold it up. Then the light will hit that because invariably this has been going on for several minutes. And that light's coming. Here it's coming. I hear the motorboat, blip, 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 blip. And then I'm down, and the light goes above again.
Mm-hmm. And so, who knows how much longer you can survive out there?
Well, I'd already given up a couple times.
What do you mean?
What's the use? But I said, no way, coach. I'm not wasting all this time. That's when I decided. And sure enough, I could hear that, but. And here comes a light, and boy, my arm goes up, and I'm help holding it up there and like this.
Holding that sign to reflect it.
Yes, and the light comes, zoom, stop, vroom, right there. And I, but, I could hear it, concentration. I'm up and down, but I can hear that motorboat. Mm-hmm. So that's when they come to pick me up. And I told them to just let me hang on. My arms, I didn't have no strength. I couldn't get in.
You were so weak from dog paddling, from holding on to that 2x4, from just keeping your head above water.
I didn't have no strength at all.
How long had you been in the water?
A little over 4.5 hours, 4.5, 5 hours.
Wow.
I'm assuming what time I left. I don't know when I left.
Yeah.
I didn't have a watch. But somebody's what the hell are we going to do? Grab. I said, grab anything, that little handle, I don't care. I had no clothes. They couldn't, and I was slicker than an onion from just from
the,
and so finally he got my leg and threw me over, and this guy just uncurling scream. He had a leg about half gone, and he threw me right on. He was laying in the bottom of the boat. Well, I couldn't see. I didn't know they had these little lights. So I was so tickled to be aboard. It was cold, man. It was cold. So this kid that was driving the boat gave me his pea jacket, pea coat. And boy, that felt so good. It was worth $1,000 if I had $1,000. I would have given anything. But that's when they picked me up, and then we headed back for the Patterson. That was the ship the motor whaleboat was from.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, when I got to the ship, I stepped on the gangway. They had it down to the water line and stepped up, and I handed him his jacket back. Thanks, Mac. Welcome. So he took off, and then his shaved tail on duty. He says, my God, sailor, where's your clothes? And I says, well, I lost them in the floating crap game. What do you think? And then I thought, he don't know what a floating crap game is. He didn't come from my neighborhood. He don't know. Because he's just looking at me. Floating crap game? I thought, oh, he don't know the rules.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's almost got me in trouble again. But the next day I confronted him, and he was really laughing.
He so said, you finally got some clothes. You probably got some food.
I got aboard, and the guys, see, I was so long getting aboard. There's only one guy picked up after me. So I got inside, and I asked him if they picked up Chubby that they know of. Chubby, yeah, the Italian cook. Yeah, he's down below an officer's mess. He's got a hell of a hole in him.
This is your best friend?
Yeah. I said, well, what's he doing? Well, he's doing best he can. Get that plugged up, it'll be a lot better. But they was operating on the mess table. So what they was doing, stopping blood best they could. So I couldn't go down there right then. But so they finally found a pair of pants. So the guys broke out all their clothes, everything, towels, everything, to give to us. Put these pants on. I couldn't put them together. They was like a V-line up. Real small. Smallest pants I ever seen in my life. So this guy handed me a shoelace. So I tied a shoelace on the top just to kind of hold them a little bit. And it was like I was fixing a bouquet. I mean, it's right in the middle. And the guys are giving me hee-haw for what for. And
sure.
I don't monkey with me. I'm sick, man. Everybody's throwing up, swallowing all that salt water by the hour.
Mm.
And we're bloated and thirsty and hungry and cold and mad.
Yeah.
So you don't fool with people when they're like that. You learn right quick when it's time to shut up. But it was really funny in a way. This kid says, hey, man, you're shaking really bad. I said, I'm cold. What the hell you think? I got no clothes. And I said, anything. You got a big towel? Anything. So he says, well, I got a Red Cross sweater that they knitted for me in a hometown they sent to the guys on the ship. You know, they all get together and they'll sponsorship or whatever. So I said, oh gosh, that'd be great. So he brought me this here knitted sweater, compliments of the American Red Cross or something, certain down in Iowa or whatever.
Right.
So I put that on, and then I said, if you got an extra towel, I'd sure like that, because I said, from my neck up, I can't even feel my head. It's cold. And I couldn't eat. I was so sick. I mean, it just bloated from that salt water, and I was full, but I was hungry, but it didn't matter. So he gave me that, so I put that on, and then they come get me and said that they wondered if I would do some identification. They said I knew most everybody, somebody I don't know who was. And I said, well, if I can help, I'd be glad to. They said, well, and by the head back, we have a place set up. We've got some of these people that we don't know who are, and they don't have any dog tags or nothing. So it would help if you could partially identify them and put us on the right track. So I said, sure. So I went out there, and it was so cold. I thought it was cold inside, but the doors and decks were shut. But once you go out in that air, oh, it just, whew. But I went up, and it was one of my cooks. So I told him, I said, that's one, we use him as a butcher. We call him the old man. I think he was 30 years old, but he was our butcher.
So here you have just narrowly escaped death, and you have to go identify those who didn't escape.
Yeah, that. Because, see, the next day they wanted to have burial at sea because these smaller stories had no place to keep these bodies.
Right.
So on our ship, if we had a little like that, we had room in our freezers because we had big freezers. And if we was out for a while, one of them was getting a little empty, but we didn't keep it going. So we could always start it up again. But these little ships don't have that luxury.
Yeah.
So that was the whole idea. So I did, and positive, and somebody else came along and they concurred. And so the Kamisaki goes, next day we're going to have Barrow at Sea. But that's tough to see your friends. But they're over with. I mean, they have no worries. And that's the only way you can look at it.
Do you look at that also and say, that could be me?
Not really.
No.
Because as far as I was concerned, that wasn't going to happen.
I guess not. If you survived what you survived, you must have had some willpower. When did you realize that you were also wounded?
You know, I didn't put it in the heart. I kept feelings on my back. I had a guy look at it, and he says, well, you got all, it looks like scratches or something. But he says, it's really weird looking. So I said, oh, okay, fine. He says, but there's no blood or nothing coming out. And I said, well, fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. So I couldn't figure that out. So the following day, we had that thing, and then we went back to Iwo, and that's when I could see him raising the flag on the second raising the flag, the big one. So I asked one of our reunions, I ran across one of our doctors. He didn't see us for about 10 days because he was an officer and he was picked up and given different treatment, of course. And most of them were pilots, so they tried to get them airplanes and got them out of there. So he says, I was wondering about that. He says, but I come to the conclusion that you was in the water immediately, that cold water sucked all the poisons and all the bacteria off those shrapnel wounds. And he said, you got a lot of them. But he says, I put you down for the Purple Heart. I said, oh, I don't need that. He said, well, you're going to get it. But he says, you no infection or nothing. So he says, there's no treatment right now for that because he said, everything's closed up. If you have problems, then they will open. But tell them to be awful careful because there might be metal in you. But when I hit the bulkhead, it was stuff that was sprayed onto the walls that was coming loose. And it was like a metal spray preservative, I don't know what to call it. And that's what I had embedded in my back.
Mm.
So he said, I think he was in there so long, it just pulled all the poisons out and stopped the bleeding. And he says, I couldn't have done a better job. He says, I got right now a whole bunch of white marks back there.
Mm-hmm.
And different people said something about it. I said, oh, yeah, I think I got shot in the war or something. You know,
it was when you were thrown against the bulkhead that you're wounded. And had you not ended up in the water, you might have had a longer recovery from that.
Yes. And I've had a couple things in my back, and I told the dermatologist, if you have it analyzed, if it's metal, would you please save it?
Uh-huh.
Because I'd like to find out if that's really what's going on.
Well, let me ask you this, too. Your best friend is this other cook, and when you get aboard, they tell you, well, he's got a big hole through him.
Yeah.
When did you get a chance to talk to him, and what did you say?
That very few minutes, I went down there and says, asked him what he was doing. And he says, in your business. I said, you're bleeding on an officer's rack and you're going to get court-martialed for it. I said, do you realize the mess you're making? And he told me what uncertain terms to get out of there and where to go. And I said, I'm halfway there already. I just want to see if he's okay. I said, you're able to raise the devil. I didn't say that, but
yeah.
More or less, and he told me again where to go, and I said, I'm on my way. He says, it's not fast enough for me. But we was real good friends, and he could never really take me, so and he knew that. So.
Well, and it's a really good thing he survived the war, because it really impacted your life. I'm going to get to that in a minute. But, you know, I had the chance to interview another sailor from your ship years ago, another redhead from your ship who's since passed away. And one of the real striking memories he had was being recovering on a hospital ship, and seeing that flag on top of Mount Suribachi. And you made reference. You saw the second flag, the more famous flag, the one that's...
I seen the first one, too.
You saw them both?
Yes.
All right, tell me the story.
Well, it's just that we didn't have binoculars or nothing. We're cooks. We have no business with them, but we go topside. If the gunners are there and you harass them enough, they'll let you use them for a second.
Look through the gun sight, which magnifies.
Yes. Yeah. I watched, but we'd see... different troops drive up, something all of a sudden big poof, and then be gone. And we had to get out of there because we're shrapnel country and we don't have helmets or nothing. So when we come there back, when they raised that bigger flag, we was out there and come back. And same thing, they let me use their binoculars. I could actually see it. But I didn't know the story.
Nobody did, sure.
See, and I couldn't figure out what was going on, but it was amazing that I could see that. I thought, gosh, this is weird, but it was like a time lapse now, I think about it. A time lapse or something. Why? Because it didn't make sense, because we was out busy, and then all of a sudden we're back like slow motion and they're raising the flag. They already did that.
Mm.
But we couldn't see hardly the first one at all.
Yeah.
Because it was, well, smaller and then a lot of stuff going on, you know.
So when you saw the second, it was a little easier to spot.
Oh, yeah. that was, like I say, and then I had actual binoculars. Before, we were looking through a gun sight, and you're here, there, and you can't, your eyeballs can't, unless you're used to that. But I thought that was great.
I know we've bounced kind of all over the place, but just thinking of Mount Suribachi, I'm reminded that you had the experience Honor Flight. And one of the first things you see is that statue, the Marine Corps Memorial, and those guys raising the flag. Was that significant for you?
Yeah, felt good.
What did it make you think of?
I was able to eat all that time. Food has always been my thing. Either mess it up, try to cook it, or learn why. But I was proud. Not always proud of my life, because I sometimes thought maybe I could have done better, but maybe, maybe not. I'll never know now, because I've about done it all. But I've had an interesting life, and I've appreciated everybody looking after me and appreciating me as a person.
Well, the main attraction on your journey to Washington, the World War II Memorial, and they have that wall of gold stars. That's 406,000 Americans who died in the war, and 318 of them died the night you almost died.
Yeah.
Did you think of those guys when you were there?
That was awful hard. I was trying to tell one of the reporters there, and I said, I don't think I can. See, I never talked about this at all. My grandkids, my wife, my daughter. My wife said once in a while would make me kind of shiver. And I didn't dwell on it because it wasn't an affliction as far as I was concerned. But when I see all that there and I think, oh, but there I go for the grace of God. And I feel good about it.
And even though he's battled some significant health challenges in the last year, he is still feeling good about it as he approaches his 95th birthday. That is Albert Henderson, one of the last remaining survivors from the sinking of the USS Bismarck Sea 75 years ago on February 21st, 1945. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
It's
Speaking of the honor flight, both Mr. Marusich and Mr. Henderson had that opportunity to visit the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. I had the privilege of visiting Mr. Henderson on February 21st, 2020, at the California Veterans Home in Fresno. He, in fact, was presented that day with an American flag that had flown over the U.S. Capitol, thanks to his Congressman Jim Costa for bestowing that honor on Mr. Henderson to mark that 75th anniversary. And since you're accessing the podcast version of this episode here at HometownHeroesRadio.com, there's time to share a little more with you. When Steve Marusich shared his story with Hometown Heroes way back in 2010, he read a poem written by one of his shipmates and shared with the rest of the survivors at a Bismarck Sea reunion.
A kamikaze hit us broadside, and again I heard men cry, and I saw men die. Our faithful old ship split apart at the seam. Above the hellish noise I heard men scream. She belched up fire with a mournful sigh, and I heard men cry, and I saw men die. The captain called out, "Abandon ship." We knew then it was the end of the trip. More hell rained down from the sky, and I heard men cry. Yes, I saw men die. 500 men died that dismal night. 500 more lived through that awful plight. On the ocean floor our ship came to lie, and I heard men cry, and I saw men die. Maybe 1,000 men died that night. It was hard to tell. 1,000 brave men we knew so well. I could be one who took that ride, for I still hear men cry, and I still see men die. Jacques LeBlanc, seaplane captain, and the USS Bismarck Sea.